Welcome to the Resilience Roundup podcast. I am your host, Lataria Walker. The Army can be a tough profession. Mix in additional responsibilities like leading troops, attending college, maintaining a home, parenting, keeping up with finances, basically living life. How can we successfully manage everything? How can we not just cope, but learn, grow, and thrive? Resilience. That's it. Resilience is the ability to persevere, adapt, and grow in dynamic or stressful environments. Resilience encompasses internal motivation, persistence, and how soldiers revitalize, recover, and adapt in order to respond constructively to challenges in their daily lives. Training and education empowers leaders and soldiers to demonstrate resilience. When individuals gain experience in applying these skills, it enables cohesive team building and drives readiness. The Resilience Roundup podcast is a place where you can find resources that will help you maintain your resilience. You are resilient. Welcome to the Resilience Roundup podcast, episode 18. I am Lataria Walker, your podcast host. Today, our guest is Dr. Emmy Betts. Dr. Betts is an emergency physician and nationally recognized leader in firearm injury prevention and suicide prevention. She is currently a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, where she is the founding director of the Firearm Injury Prevention Initiative. She oversees a multi-million dollar research portfolio of complex, community-engaged, mixed methods studies funded by the National Institutes of Health and the Department of Defense. Dr. Betts is a nationally recognized expert in firearm injury prevention and has been invited to work with numerous organizations spanning the civilian veteran spectrum. Examples include medical organizations such as the American Medical Association, American College of Surgeons, the American Bar Association, multiple VA work groups, the Department of Defense Suicide Prevention Office, and White House events and initiatives under the Obama, Trump, and Biden administrations. In 2023, Dr. Betts was elected to the National Academy of Medicine. This episode's topic is securing hope, strategies for lethal means safety. Dr. Betts and I will have an in-depth discussion on the subject, including how Army personnel can integrate LMS into their roles as a means of reducing harmful behaviors and preventing suicide, along with explaining how LMS is carried out within the Department of Defense and addressed in the Army Strategic Plan. Dr. Betts will address misconceptions about suicide and LMS, provide the latest research updates, and recommend evidence-based activities that you listeners can adopt. Dr. Betts, thank you, ma'am, for joining us today. Please tell us a bit more about yourself and your work.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here. I know I have a lot of fancy sounding titles, but at the end of the day, what motivates me in my work is my experiences as an ER doctor and just as it really is as a family member and friend to people who have been through tough times. I work as an emergency physician in a large hospital in Colorado where every day that I work, I care for people with suicide risk. And I spend a lot of time thinking about how we can best support them as they get through tough times. I'm also someone like probably everyone listening. I'm someone who's lost friends and family members to firearm suicide. And so I do what I can to prevent others from going through that pain. And then lastly, I'm a native Coloradan and not a gun owner myself, but have many friends and family members who are. And I think I respect and value the diverse cultural experiences and perspectives of individuals in this country. And all the work that I do is really grounded in wanting to support people in finding the solutions that work for them and their families to prevent these injuries and these suicides that nobody wants.
Wow. Thank you for your work and your commitment to this very important subject. You know, before we get into the actual interview, I have to ask this question. What is your reasoning, or what was your reasoning for getting into this line of work and study?
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes, again, you know, from what I mentioned in my frontline experiences, you know, as a doctor and as just a family member and friend, but then really wondering, like, how do we actually do this? Maybe that's the ER doctor practical part of me, but, you know, I understood the theory, but then it meant, what do we actually do to help people in these difficult moments? And how do we make it easier for people to make choices and make changes to be safe? And so I think you'll probably see that in a theme in the things we're going to talk about. I'm really focused on how we simplify the process, how we make it easier for people to make safe choices.
Wow, excellent. Okay, we'll start with the basics here. What is lethal means safety? What does that mean?
Yeah, so lethal means safety is a little bit of a clunky term. I'm just going to acknowledge that. We haven't come up with a better one yet. But what it really refers to is the role that the method of suicide plays in the likelihood that someone will die. And then recognizing that we need to take steps to reduce access to those lethal methods. So, for example, jumping off of a high bridge is likely to be lethal. And so many communities have taken steps, for example, to put barriers beneath bridges or on the bridge themselves to make it so that a person who is in a suicide crisis can't physically jump off of the bridge. That's a really practical example. And so what it means we need to think about is the lethality of a method, which I know we're going to get more into. And particularly for the methods that are most lethal, those are the ones we want to be focusing on in terms of making sure we're reducing access.
Good, good. That's a very good and clear definition of lethal means safety. So in keeping with that theme, tell us why lethal means safety is important.
So the reason lethal means safety is important is because suicide isn't inevitable. You know, we know from science a couple of key facts. So the first is that most people in a suicide crisis, even people who attempt suicide, don't later die by suicide. If we help them through that rough patch, they're going to get better and they're not going to die by suicide. So it's not inevitable. We know, for example, even among people who attempt suicide, if they survive, only 10% later die by suicide, which is actually, you know, a really positive thing that we need to be focused on. So there's hope. Lethal means safety is also important because we know if somebody can't access the method that they were planning to use, they don't automatically switch to another method. So again, highlighting that suicide is preventable. The reason we know many people don't substitute is because the period of suicide crisis can actually be very brief. There might be a lot of things leading up to it, but we know from science that the time from deciding to take action, so deciding to attempt suicide, to actually doing it can be in the space of minutes to hours. And so putting time and distance between someone and a lethal method can be life-saving. If somebody was planning to jump off of a bridge, for example, and they get to the bridge and there's a barrier, even if they think about using another method, by the time they get to that method, they may have changed their mind and they may no longer attempt. Or if someone was planning to use a firearm and they go to try to get the firearm and the gun is locked up and they can't get to it, they may not attempt with something else, but even if they do, it's less likely to be lethal. So that's why we really focus on reducing access to the most lethal methods of suicide to get people through that temporary crisis, to get them the help that they need, because we know that that leads to more people surviving.
What makes a method lethal?
You know, simply what makes a method lethal is really just how dangerous it is. I think people understand guns, for example, firearms are made to be lethal weapons. That's what they were intended for. And so we know suicide attempts with a firearm, about 90% of the time the person dies. There's not a second chance. Medications can be lethal depending on what they are and their toxicity within the body, but also recognizing that we have antidotes for many medications. So suicide attempt by overdose, we know on the whole, only maybe 5 to 20% of them are likely to result in death. Similarly, we know self-harm, meaning like cutting behaviors, also are less likely to be lethal, honestly, because it's just physically more difficult to cause a lethal injury from that method.
Wow. We've heard in your bio that you do lots of work with suicide prevention. So we'll switch gears a bit. What are the national suicide prevention priorities?
So I think this is a good point for me to emphasize that lethal means safety, which is what we're focusing on today, is just one part of what we think about as a comprehensive approach to suicide prevention, which is really what the priorities are on a national scale. So we need also to be thinking about things like encouraging help-seeking behavior, so normalizing it, destigmatizing, getting help when you're in a tough patch. We need to make sure that people have access to effective treatments, so understanding what are the effective approaches for therapy or for medications, for support programs, for the social stressors that can lead to suicide risk. We also want to think about, again, lethal means safety, which is what we're focusing on, which is really about making and supporting protective environments, meaning how do we make the environment safe for someone while they're getting better? And then other priorities for national suicide prevention priorities include things like engaging communities and making communities overall more supportive of individuals, helping people know how to intervene, be sort of bystanders and supporting friends, as well as then understanding how we support people after a suicide attempt, both the person themselves as well as those around them, so that we hopefully prevent additional sort of so-called copycat suicides.
Wow. So I know that as we're talking about lethal means safety and suicide prevention, there's another piece to this, means reduction. Tell us about that approach.
Yeah, so the means, we've sort of talked about, the means is really just the method of suicide. So it could be a firearm, could be medications, could be bridges or places where people might jump from a height. So the reduction piece is really just about reducing access to those things, particularly during times of risk, putting time and space between someone and a lethal method. When I think about means reduction, I want to emphasize that there are two pieces to it. So the first is, what can we do to make access to lethal methods reduced all the time? And for example, that means always storing firearms in a way so they're inaccessible to people who potentially might be at risk, right? That's sort of the equivalent to putting your seatbelt on every time you get in the car. But means reduction is also about taking specific steps to reduce access for someone who is in a crisis. So once we recognize that a soldier, that a family member, that a friend is going through a rough patch, we want to be thinking specifically, how do we make sure that person doesn't have access to lethal methods? And that's a lot like having a designated driver for someone to make sure that they can get home safely from a place where they've been drinking alcohol.
Got it. What are some common misconceptions about lethal means safety? This can get interesting.
Yeah. So I think we've touched on some of them. So we know sometimes people think, well, it doesn't matter, they'll just find another method. But we know people don't. You know, people don't usually substitute another method if they can't access, for example, the firearm they wanted to use. But even if they did, they're less likely to die. So I see lots of people in the ER after suicide attempts by medication overdose. And I'll tell you, most of them get better, either because the medication wasn't toxic or because we have medical treatments to help them get better and give them that second chance. But there's not a second chance, for example, with a firearm. So it's really important that we get rid of that myth that sort of it doesn't matter. It does matter. And reducing access to the most lethal means of suicide can save lives. I think another misconception, especially when we're talking about firearms, and I want to address this one head on, this is not about gun control. This is not about confiscation. We're not talking about legislation here. We are talking about generally voluntary actions that people can take for themselves, for their families, for their communities. So again, this is really, we're not focused on law enforcement stepping in, confiscating weapons, that kind of thing. You know, there are cases where that might be, it might get to that point. But most of what we're really going to be talking about today is engaging even the at-risk people themselves in voluntary changes temporary action. It's not about asking someone to change who they are as a person, to give up firearms forever, to not go hunting anymore and so forth. It's about, again, it's a little like the designated driver approach. You're not asking someone to give up their driver's license. You're not telling them they can never drink again. You're saying, hey, we want to keep you safe while you're not at your best.
Wow, this is a great segue into my next question. You mentioned community. So what is the importance of community and culture when it comes to lethal means safety?
I don't think I can overemphasize how important it is that we as a community be really leaning into the space and doing what we can to help people be safe and recognize that this can't just be about the at-risk person making changes themselves. We can't leave these decisions and these actions until someone is at risk. Because honestly, if someone is in a suicide crisis, they're already dealing with a lot. And so what can we as a community be doing ahead of time and sort of upstream before that risk develops, but also during that period of risk to really support the person? And relatedly, I think this is about how do we encourage the broader cultural change? So for example, how do we normalize secure storage of personal weapons at home? So specifically making sure that guns are stored in a way that they are not accessible to unauthorized users. So why does that matter? Well, let's say there are teenagers in the home. Nobody wants to talk about this, but teenagers kill themselves. And when they use a firearm, it's almost always a gun from the home. So things like always making sure that firearms are secured, locked up so that unauthorized individuals can't get to them means that somebody who's in a temporary crisis maybe won't be able to access that weapon and won't be able to die by suicide. So that's a broader cultural change that we need to get to. And again, it's a little like, how did we get to the point where everybody basically, you get in a car and you put on your seatbelt, that's a very normal behavior. And I think that's what we want to get to in terms of culture change when we think about access to lethal means. The secondary piece of culture and community, again, is the designated driver model. If you're out with your friends and somebody's not maybe at their best and maybe shouldn't be driving, you don't give them the keys, but you also don't call the police to confiscate their license and keys. You do what you can to make sure that they can get home safely. And that friends don't let friends drive drunk has really become a totally normal part of our culture, where we see alcohol distributors, beer companies, we see the NFL promoting that concept of having a designated driver, of looking out for friends. And I think that's really where we would like to get to when it comes to lethal means safety and suicide prevention. That again, it's looking out for your buddies. It's taking steps to make sure that you are always being as safe as possible if you have a firearm at home, but also taking steps if the time comes when someone's at risk.
Wow, those are very good examples. Thank you for those. So let's move on into firearm storage. Let's talk about what safe firearm storage is and what are some options for safe firearm storage?
Yeah, thanks for asking. And you'll notice I sometimes say safe storage, I sometimes say secure storage. For today's conversation, those really mean the same thing. The safest way to store a firearm at home is with the firearm unlocked and locked up, and then the ammunition stored separately. Because the reason that is the safest is because it's preventing any kind of accidental use. Let's say a kid picks it up and doesn't know it's loaded, for example. So storing a gun unloaded with the ammunition separate is the safest method in that it is the most likely to prevent accidental injury or suicide. But I want to call out that there are many firearm owners who don't want to do that with at least one firearm because they want to have one firearm loaded and readily accessible in case of, for example, home break-in. In that situation, though, there are still storage options that prevent unauthorized access, specifically quick action lock boxes that can be opened with a sort of number combination, or biometric lock boxes are safe. But I want to really just emphasize there are a lot of storage devices out there. There's something that can work for every home situation. And I think it's important that we in this prevention space recognize the cable locks, for example, that are cheap and we often hand out are not something that many people want to use. And so I would love for us to be thinking about how do we make it easier for people to get the firearm locking devices that work for them in their home situation. But again, really just to come back to safe or secure firearm storage means making sure firearms are not accessible to unauthorized users. So specifically locked up in a way that other people can't get to them. And that kind of secure storage can prevent suicide, but it can also prevent theft, accidental injury, or the gun being used in another inappropriate way.
Is there ever a time that we should consider out-of-home storage? And if so, when is that?
Yeah, great question. So out-of-home storage is something that we know many people turn to in various circumstances. From large studies, we know maybe about a quarter of gun owners say that they've used out-of-home storage within the past 5 years. Out-of-home storage means moving firearms out of the home for storage, and out of the home specifically can mean at a gun shop, at a firearm range. Sometimes it can mean storing it with a family member or a friend or a neighbor. I do want to point out that the different states have different laws in terms of how easy it is or how legal it is to store a gun with another individual. So why might people do this? So in the context of suicide, certainly we recommend moving guns out of the home because it puts the most time and space between an at-risk person and that lethal method or that lethal means. But people might also think about out-of-home storage if, for example, they're going on a long trip, maybe a deployment, maybe they're rehabbing or selling their home. Maybe they have grandkids coming to visit or others in the home who shouldn't have access to a gun. So there's a lot of work going on right now. We're really excited about some programs we're doing with firearm businesses to really make it easier for them and in terms of providing storage or getting involved in promoting these messages.
Great. As we come to a close, can you offer any additional resources for listeners who are seeking more information on this topic?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Army does have a full lethal means safety toolkit that listeners can look to that has additional programs, messages, information on how to communicate about this, sort of some of the frequently asked questions, some of the key talking points that we've gone through. There are also some programs out there that have been developed working with the military, but are not military specific or military owned programs. Project Safeguard is one that people can look to. That's a sort of person-to-person upstream secure storage messaging program that's called Project Safeguard. There's another one called the Overwatch Project that is a really great program that really encourages friends to step up and talk to their buddies if they're worried. And then Pause to Protect is a new program that we are working on that has a website that is focused on firearm retailers, so specifically civilian firearm businesses and encouraging them to support service members, family members, and other community members who might want information or storage options.
Got it. Dr. Betts, what is one takeaway you want our listeners to glean from today's episode? And along that same vein, are there any final thoughts that you'd like to share with our listeners before we close?
Yeah, I would say that I don't think I can overestimate how important this topic can be and how impactful, you know, and if there's one thing you can do for your family, for the service members you support in terms of suicide prevention, I really think that reducing access to lethal means, particularly to firearms, can be the difference between life and death. And I don't want listeners to be nervous or afraid of bringing these topics up. The firearm industry is really doing a ton of work in this space, recognizing that secure storage, that voluntary temporary changes in access during times of suicide risk, that those are all in line with what it means to be a responsible firearm owner. So again, this isn't about politics. It's not about gun control. This is about us supporting cultural changes to prevent the injuries and the deaths that nobody wants to see.
Thank you so much, Dr. Betts, for joining us and for sharing this very important information with our listeners today. Listeners, I hope you heard something today that will help you to continue to build upon your resilience. Thank you for listening and have an amazing day. Thank you for joining this month's Resilience Roundup podcast. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please continue to follow the Directorate of Prevention, Resilience, and Readiness on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay resilient.